Herzlich willkommen bei Meditation Coaching Alive. Mein Name ist Michael Kurt, auch bekannt als Curse. Und in der heutigen Folge spreche ich mit dem Autoren, Yogalehrer und Meditationsexperten Magnus Fried, was übersetzt großer Frieden heißt, über inneren Frieden, äußeren Frieden und die Reise zu uns selbst. Viel Freude damit. Stille finden in einer hektischen Welt. So heißt das neue Buch von Magnus Fried, was neben vielen anderen Sprachen auch ins Deutsche übersetzt worden ist. Und ich spreche heute mit ihm über ganz viel inneren Frieden, äußeren Frieden, das Kultivieren von Meditation, die Verbindung von Körper und Geist durch Yoga, Meditation, aber auch über ganz persönliche Dinge. Er hat eine echt interessante Lebensgeschichte, die ihn über ein Patenkind seiner Mutter mit Tibet, dem tibetischen Buddhismus, verbindet und die ihn auf sehr, sehr interessante Wege geführt hat. Magnus Fried hat neben seinen Büchern auch eine Yogaschule und gibt internationale Retreats, sowohl in persona als auch virtuell online. Dieses Gespräch haben wir vor einigen Wochen aufgezeichnet, so dass die aktuelle politische Weltlage überhaupt nicht zum Gespräch kommt. Was aber nicht bedeutet, dass die Dinge, die Magnus erzählt hat, nicht auch in der jetzigen Situation sehr hilfreich und heilsam für uns sein können. Ich habe mich wahnsinnig gefreut, mit Magnus zu sprechen. Wir sind danach auch ein bisschen in Kontakt geblieben. Wir haben nachher herausgefunden, dass er früher auch sogar in einer Rap-Gruppe war, Beats produziert und als Songwriter gearbeitet hat und sogar ganz viele Leute in dem deutschen Musikbusiness kennt, die ich auch kenne. Also ich hatte am Ende sogar das Gefühl, einen Freund getroffen zu haben. Das war sehr schön. Man hört es, glaube ich, auch in dem Gespräch, dass wir uns gut verstanden haben. Ich wünsche euch viel Spaß bei dieser Unterhaltung, bei diesem Austausch und hoffe, dass ihr es genauso genießt, wie ich es genossen habe. Viel Freude damit.
Once again, thank you very much for your time and for speaking. For the people listening now, we already exchanged, we're already talking, we're speaking, but I want to jump a little bit back. In the back of your book and in the beginning of your book, one of the first things that struck me is that it said that you discovered meditation when you were a teenager. Now, I think, you know, a couple of years ago, you know, that was a little bit uncommon because I have the feeling that a lot of people, they either have to go through a life crisis, you know, and to discover meditation, or they have to go to a bunch of yoga classes. And then through that, maybe they end up with meditation. I don't know so many teenagers that weren't sort of born into, you know, a Buddhist family or something like that, that encounter meditation. So I'm curious, How was that for you? How did you find meditation? How did it find you? And what was it about it that didn't like bore you to death, but that fascinated you?
Yeah. First of all, thank you for having me here. I'm happy that you want to talk to me about this topic, meditation, which is so dear to me. And well, it's quite a long story, and you have to cut me if I go on too much.
We have time. It's fine.
Yeah. That's good. Actually, it was when I was a small kid. My mother was very interested in engaging in sponsor a child in a different culture. And quite coincidentally, she'd have read an article about the Tibetans in diaspora because of the Chinese occupation and the exile movement that's going on since 1950, 59, something like that. So she reached out after reading this article to SOS Children's Village.
Yes.
And with the request that I want to become a sponsor of a Tibetan child in exile. And so did happen. And the boy's name was Karmat Sering. And ever since my first memories, my mother and father always talked about there is this godbrother of yours, and he lives in India, a little bit south of Dharamsala, to be specific. And we will help him with economical support until he left school. So we got the same opportunity, just like you and your sister. So that was very natural for me. And I can't remember that we ever talked about him like we felt pity or something like that. It was just a natural part of our extended Perifere family. So we became pen pals, and he was a few years older than me. So of course I always loved receiving his letters with wonderful drawings and stuff like that, and encouraging words to me. And then later on, my mother and father actually invited him to our home. They had plans to adopt him as well, but that didn't happen. But at least they wanted to spend time with him. So when I was about 16, 17, they invited him to our home, and he stayed for 3 months. And at that time, Karma studied at university in Punjab. And he was very skilled in English, and he had a really good perspective both on history and politics globally, and of course on Tibetan culture and Buddhist culture. So I was in this very age where I was quite confused, actually, because I didn't know that. But now, retrospectively, I know that I had diagnosed with ADHD.
Okay.
Yeah. So I had a lot of restlessness inside me, a lot of anxiety, a lot of restlessness. And I had a very short span of attention. Yeah. And Christianity didn't attract me very much, and alcohol and drugs neither did. Mm-hmm. So at that very point, Karma was invited to our house, and we spent a lot of time together. And of course, we had a very special and quite rare connection, actually, because it was not only a Tibetan man coming to our house, he was actually kind of my brother as well.
Because
we've been swapping letters for so many years, and he also used our last name when he was signing the letter. So I mean, he was very close.
That's right.
And my mother put so much effort in this. She became friend with the principal in the children's village, and she knew quite a lot of people there. So we spent so much time together discussing questions about life, meaning of life, and what perspective is the right way to have, and the pros and cons about Buddhism and pros and cons about Christianity and other philosophies. But at the end of his visit, I was very clear that I kind of felt that I found something that was really attracted me. We took a decision that I was going to visit him as soon as I left school. And at the same time, I started to explore the world of meditation at that time on my own from a book, actually.
Okay. Which book do you remember?
It was a book about Dalai Lama, a very short, little, thin book, something called Introduction to Buddhism, I think it was. I also found a few more at the local library, but there were only a few at that time because I'm grown up in a quite small town. But what happened there was quite extraordinary. And with knowing that I had this problem with ADHD, maybe it's not so strange, but I had a very interesting experience where I closely felt that the restlessness and anxiety is not me. It's a part of me, and it's there, and it can share space with me, but it's not 100% me. And I've had that very clear experience when I did the shamatha meditation. I learned how to focus and stay attentive to one point for some longer time. I felt that things are moving, but there is something that is completely still. And at that young age, I felt such a relief. I felt like the burden from my shoulders were offloaded, and I felt light and very happy. And I felt that this door can't be closed again. So
How old were you at that time?
I think I was something like 17 at that time. Okay. Something like that. And
this was an experience that you had in a meditation practice that you did?
Yes. And I had that, and I had it many times, and I wouldn't say it was very deep experience, mm-hmm. but for that person that I was at that time, it was enough, because I had no body-mind connection, and I had no tools at all, and I had no adult throughout my childhood, teacher or anything like that, that told me that you might change perspective and see it in this from this direction instead. That I always was this kid in school that people were saying, you talk too much, you should shut up, you should be more concentrated, and don't move so much all the time. I heard so much of these things, but I never heard that maybe you can come beyond this, or maybe you can use those things to see a different part of yourself. But here it was very clear instructions for me that sticked. It worked on me, and for sure it worked even better because it was in a context that karma introduced me to. So I got like the big framework of meditation, and I got the big cultural framework that Tibetan Buddhism is for sure. So after that, I started to meditate quite frequently, and I was so enthusiastic. And then when I left school, immediately I went to India, and I traveled around with Karma, and he showed me all those things that you should see up in Dharamsala. And we also went to Nepal. And at that time, wonderful. I was so interested in Dharma. So I wanted to go into each and every monastery. And Karma was a bit tired of me. But again, I had a great introduction, because he could also not only teach me about Dharma and introduce me to the right places to visit, that he could tell me about the pros and cons, and learned me how to question things before you jump into it. And I think I really needed that, because I was so young. Otherwise, I would have done so many things.
you would have become a monk right away, maybe.
I think so, but I was deep in love with this girl in Sweden. So I wanted to go back home. And that girl is actually my wife now. So.
Oh, wow. That's sweet. That's nice. It's like, I feel like we're already in a movie. It's like a movie. It's a movie life. That's wonderful. That's really wonderful. I love this also, this connection that, this deep connection that you've had ever since you were a kid through this person, through your brother, right? Mm. Through your brother over there, and through just this connection with him, and also, of course, through your mother, who seemingly also had some sort of connection there, some fascination and some just deep feeling. This is the right thing. This is what we should do. This is where I want to invest my energy, my time. You know, that's very nice. So when you came back from this time that you had in India, Nepal, you did go to university, and you said, okay, this is what I also want to study, right? So so you started to study. Indology, right? Indology, how do you say it in English?
Yes. First, I did 3 years when I studied history of literature, and also history of religion studies. So at that time, I took all chances that was given to me. So when I was about to write my thesis in history of literature, I wrote about Milarepa's poetry, the Tibetan Jogi.
Yeah.
And then when I wrote my thesis in history of religion, I also wrote about Milarepa from another perspective. And
could you really just quickly... for the people listening to the podcast, and some people are acquainted with Buddhism and so on, but a lot of people might not know this. who is Milarepa and what is his poetry like? Can you, because I also think it's super beautiful, but yes. could you give a short introduction? What we're talking about?
Milarepa, he was born somewhere around, I think, 11th century, 10th or 11th century, up in the Himalayas. And the story goes like he was fooled by some relatives when his father died. And his uncle kind of stole all the money that was left there. And this brought Milarepa to learn black magic, actually. Mm-hmm. And he took his revenge on the uncle, and he actually killed quite a few people. So his karma wasn't the best. But sooner or later, he understood this, and he came to terms with his destiny, and took a decision that I want to become enlightened. So the story of Milarepa goes that he goes from cave to cave, to teacher, to receive the best teachings, to become free from his karma and to become enlightened in one lifetime. And it's a really kind of dramatic life story, because he meets a very stubborn teacher called Marpa that tells him to build a tower. This could be one way of becoming free of his karma. And it took maybe years to build this tower for his new teacher. And when he was finished with the tower, Marpa said, "What is that? I never told you to build a tower. Take it down." And then he did this again. "Now I want you to build another thing up there," and blah, 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 blah. And then sooner or later, Milarepa looks like he's ready for the teachings. So he received the teachings from Marpa, and he spent his life up in caves, Himalayas, doing meditation in a very non-monastic way. He had long hair, and he looked like a real yogi. And he's known that he only ate nettles. Is it nettles?
Nettles, huh?
Nettles, yes, thank you. Okay. Green in his skin. And he also wore this white robe. And this is interesting, I think, because Milarepa, Repa is one that his clothes is made of cotton, actually. And what does that say about him? It says that he know the really skilled, very interesting breathing techniques, like Tummo and other names, like Wim Hof is famous for, that he doesn't need more than cotton up in the cold Himalayas to keep warm, because he knew techniques. And of course, he was writing a lot of poetry, and he sang them wherever he came. And he was known a little bit like this nyumpas, like these crazy yogis, that instead of teaching with word, he could sing and do other different things, show different skills. So he was like a father of, one of the starting points for one of the sects we call in Tibetan Buddhism called Kagyupa. Yeah. So that's a little bit about Milarepa.
So you were fascinated also by the poetry, by the songs that he wrote, and so you incorporated that into your thesis and into your studies. Yeah.
Yes, very much. And when I studied that, I understood that this could be even better. What if I can read it in Tibetan instead of translations? Yeah. So that made me move from the south of Sweden to Stockholm instead, because at that time, not any longer, they offered classical Tibetan in the university in the field of Indology. And at the same time, same girl moved to Stockholm before me. So that might also...
maybe had a little something to do with that. Yeah.
Love or Tibetan, we never know. So then I started to study Indology 3 years. When you study Indology, I started with Tibetan language 1 year. And when I was going on a little higher level on Tibetan studies, I didn't know that Sanskrit was a requirement. So okay. I had to study Sanskrit for 1 year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But this was a long time ago, and language is always hard to remember. So, well, I can read the Sanskrit alphabet, of course, and I have some understanding, but I couldn't say that I'm skilled at all.
So would you say that by reading some of these texts in the original languages, would you say that something between the lines is, when you translate them, there will always be something missing? Would you say that there is something more in there when you read it? Or would you say, well, there are really good translations that capture the essence and so on? I'm very interested in this because, you know, I'm a rapper. I work with language a lot, and it absolutely fascinates me what language does and what it doesn't do, and what translation does and doesn't do. And I've had this a funny but also very teachable moment. I released two albums in Japan. So I rap in the German language. So I went over to Japan and I played some concerts, and we, you know, but in order to sort of bring the music to the people there, the first album, what we did is I translated all my lyrics into English, which was super hard. Because every line I had the feeling, even though it was my words and I knew exactly what I was trying to say, every line I had the feeling it loses some meaning and it creates a little bit of a new meaning, you know, when I was even translating from English to German. And then some Japanese person translated my English translation into Japanese. So now I'm sitting there and I'm having a conversation with some Japanese journalists. And this thing happened where this one journalist said to me, so in your song such and such, you mentioned that blah, 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 blah. And he tells me some sentence or some thing that I mentioned. And I say, I've never heard about this. Like, I never said that. And it's not even close to anything I said. He pulls out my CD with the Japanese translation. And he points to the sentence and says, but it says right here, it's written in your CD that this is what you say. And then we sort of reconstructed it. I was like, oh, it's this song and it's the second verse and it's in the middle. So it must be, this is what I say in the original German. I wrote it down, I translated it. And then we sort of, the interview stopped and we got into this discussion about language and translations. But this was a very crucial moment for me where I realized what can go wrong with translation. So I'm just interested in your perspective on how that works and how can you avoid this or like how is that for you?
I mean, it's I totally can relate to that. I totally understand. And now you are talking about how to say colloquial languages, modern languages. It would be even closer. But the language I studied at university was classical Tibetan. So it's a language not spoken. And of course, it has a lot of common with the spoken Tibetan, but it's not the same at all.
Yes,
many different words and many different way of expressing things. But I think it's very difficult. That's the first thing that comes to my mind. And also, like the text I've been working, spent some time with now, it's written on meter. And things that are written on meter very often means that you kind of shorten things and the author maybe leave things out for you to be understood by the context itself. Mm-hmm. So coming as a Swedish person, trying to understand all those things is very difficult. And then also the Tibetan language is very, very different structure than at least Swedish and English. It's a system of particles that plays a major role in the syntax. So sometimes it can be quite fragmented and pronouns and other things can be left out. So it's a little bit of how to say, first understand the meaning of the words, understand the context, and understand the meter, how it's supposed to be. At least what I do is I first try to translate one version that is very grammatical correct, which is not very nice to read, actually, because it's a bit, it doesn't flow.
It's like clunky. It's like,
clunky is the right word. And then when I understand what is there, what is said there, then, of course, you can be very free when you translate it to English or Swedish. Because you have that understanding and you have to adapt it to your language setting. But compared to, I studied a little Sanskrit as well, and Sanskrit is more complex in its grammatical structure, but also maybe gives a little bit more exact meaning in a way. This is hard to explain. Mm-hmm. But I found the Tibetan language quite difficult sometimes. And also in terms of pronouncing the words, Tibetan is much more difficult than Sanskrit.
Okay. So would you say now when we come back to the texts of Buddhism and catching the essence of you know, the Buddhist teachings, you know, especially if they are from another era, sometimes the texts that you read in another language and so on. And what struck me just now, what really stayed with me, what you said is that first you sort of have to really understand what this is about, you know. So this leads me to a question also that is more related to, let's say, like how one would learn about meditation and Buddhism and so on. Would you say that, you know, it is possible to just sort of read a book, have a translation, have a good translation, read a book and sort of understand what it's about, and then you practice, which of course is how you started in some way, you know. But then you also had the different context. You also had your friend that you could have a discussion with and that could sort of explain things to you. So I think my question is going there. Would you say that it's that people that one can learn how to meditate, or one can learn about Buddhism? Maybe those are also two different things. So maybe it's even, maybe let's even split it like this. Could one learn how to meditate from a book? And could one learn about Buddhism or really practice Buddhism from a book? Maybe these are two questions, but maybe they are connected somehow. What would you say from your experience?
Of course, you can. Of course, you can that. And we live in a very good times for learning things, because nowadays there are so many accessible online courses and apps and other stuff that explains quite a lot. And you can find on YouTube very skilled Buddhist teachers that explains what meditation really is and stuff like that. So of course, I think you can up till some point, but then I think you need something that catalyzes your practice, because maybe if you just do it on your own from a book, at least I felt so. I didn't know exactly if I was doing right. I knew that it's something like this. I do exactly what's written here, but then I have my experiences and my reactions will be quite personal. And at some point you need a teacher or sangha or a dharma or spiritual friend or something like that to get some feedback from, so you know that you are on the right path. Because at least what I felt, that I really want to invest quite a lot in this, a lot of time. I wasn't satisfied with just some stress reduction or something like that. Because if you just after those effects known in the field of mindfulness, that some stress reduction, then I'm quite sure that you can use an app or you can use a YouTube video or something like that. But if you want to dig deeper and to really have a practice on a daily basis, and like you're walking a path, then I think you need something more.
But as a starting point, and you also said this reduction of stress, it's a starting point, but at the same time, I think it is such a crucial starting point.
Yes,
you might say, yeah, you know, some you hear some people. I sometimes even say that, yeah, meditation is so much more than just and burnout prevention or stress reduction, right? But at the same time, this is such an important point to start, because we are in our modern life so full with impressions and triggers and inner movements and thought patterns that we almost know nothing about.
Yes.
So we're almost like remote controlled by habits and habitual emotions and so on and so on. And then it just overwhelms us with impressions from inside and impressions from outside. And this also connects to your book, which is just called Silence in German, Stille. I think you find a very wonderful way to present short, applicable practices into everyday life. You always put them in a little context. You tell a little story, a little anecdote, and so on. So I picked many, many different phrases or many different little impressions that I wanted to ask you about or maybe comment on. But that's first, cool. I would like to know from you what inspired you to write this kind of book. Like, what led you from being deep in studying the Tibetan language and the culture and really going into the Buddhist practice? And you could say, like, you're really going in, and as you just said, you want a practice, you need a teacher and so on. This is like deep in the stuff, right? So what inspired you out of that to say, okay, I would like to present a collection of thoughts and very simple practices that do this, that go a little bit more into silence, that reduce the stress and so on. So how did that come about? How did this idea and this collection of anecdotes, how did that start?
I think it was, actually, I released one more book in Swedish. Mm-hmm. It was released 2017. It's called Rest Stop, and it's more like an introduction to mindfulness. It's very much a typical mindfulness book that is a little text and then an exercise, text, exercise like this. Yes. So I did that, and that was also, that's another story, but that's also... a red line story. That's something that happened in my life. My daughter was diagnosed with a rare disease, rare condition. In that very special, all those years we spent at hospital, I share in this book how I use meditation to actually don't fall apart, more or less. So that was that book.
Yes.
And then, so when I got the request to write another book about meditation, I felt that, well, I already wrote one and I don't know if I can do this again. There's so much said there. But then I got this idea that I've always been writing poetry since I was quite young, and I always loved poetry a lot. And it's absolutely the literature that I consume most in my everyday life. So I got this idea that maybe I can try to write about stillness and meditation, and that the reading itself is like a contemplation or a meditation. Mm-hmm. So it's not much exercise and stop and do the exercise. It's more like reading will offer stillness to the reader. Mm. So that was my take. So it took quite a long time to find that tone. And it's like life always is. It's like funny. You try to reinvent new things. But then I went back and wrote like I did when I was 20 and wrote poetry. And then, oh, there it is. Let's do like that. And I already know that. So that comes easy for me. So I more found that flow in the words and language and syntax and length of sentences and stuff like that. So, and then I explored quite a bit, and since I wrote so much about the word mindfulness and about the new secular mindfulness and the traditional, where it comes from in the first book, I wanted to come away a little bit from that word. So I played around with stillness I dig deep into Buddhism, I think I always been searching for stillness. That yes. I look back at that young guy who very with all his restlessness and tics in his body sat down to meditate. I think that it was stillness that he was looking for, peace of mind and stillness. So I tried to play around with that and see how can we find stillness in all situations in life, even where it's very noisy and even when life doesn't allow us to see it so clear. So that was my take. So it was like I was pursuing for stillness in 1 year, and I was looking for it everywhere. And this modern society, where is stillness? And what is considered stillness? And that was also that's something that changed for me over the time I wrote the book, that because stillness is not always what we Buddhists consider as stillness. Stillness can be many things. And if you are from the countryside and it's always been silent and nothing is happening, maybe coming to the big city where the noise is constant and you can just be inside a big group of people that are the same like you, maybe that is stillness. So this make me, and I also talked with people that did quite a lot of research about stillness, which gave me a lot of inspiration for the book. And then it boiled down to, in the beginning I had some more interviews in the book, but after some time I boiled it down to more just essays.
One of the sentences, quite a few, but one of the sentences, for example, maybe you could say something about it. And now we're coming to the translation, because I'm going from the German translation, putting it into English and putting it back to you. Yeah. Maybe you never said this. but I'm also poetically paraphrasing.
Yes.
And maybe just you can comment about this sentence. It can be an act of liberation to stand still at a red traffic light.
Yes, that is. I think it's you translated it nice, and I think it's actually what it's all about. It's a choice you have, and it's nothing that happens at a specific point when you have that gap in life, when you can go to retreat on a beach somewhere and start meditating. I'm not so interested in that, actually. I don't have time to wait for those occasions. I'm more into make practice your life. Everything is a retreat if you want to. And it's a choice. It's like you're standing on an edge from moment to moment experience of life, that you can choose either one way or another way. And it was so clear when I came to that red light that morning, and I saw some people, they ignored the red light and just ran away, and some people, they immediately looked down their cell phones, and I felt, well, it will take 1 minute until it will be switching to green again. Let's see, I can do a meditation here. And it totally changed. I started to see sunlight in the windows, like mirrors, and I saw the sky wasn't exactly gray, of course, in the gray scale, but not exactly. And I saw people's faces, and I felt my breath, and I felt the ground under my feet. So this is actually one of the passages that many people liked in the book. And they used to say that, I always think about you when I stand on the red light.
That is wonderful, man.
Yes.
That's wonderful. Imagine that. Like, you know, that's wonderful.
Yes,
it's wonderful. That's such a wonderful, wonderful feedback, you know. And there are many examples like this in the book. There's also one about replying to emails that that make you mad, you know, like... You know, so you offer different of these practices. But going back to the traffic light, because it's so common, because it's something that happens to everyone, almost everyone, almost every day, if you live in a city or even a village, you know, you might stand there. And what I love about what you just said is also the word choice. That a lot of times, even if the life is very hectic, many situations that we get in, we do have a choice. We do have a choice. What do we do with this? So maybe you could say something about this moment of choice, or and how we can recognize it when it presents itself, and how, what can we do with it?
I think it's a matter of not being so. It's the same with the story about the mails, where I tell a story about Lincoln. He writes hot letters that he puts in his cupboards, and then he read it next morning. And then if it's fine, he sends it.
Can you say what a hot letter is? Can you just in a word or two explain?
It's a hot letter. It was supposed that when Lincoln was in his president position, he felt anger in a situation. He felt anger, and he was supposed to respond in a letter to some opponent. He first wrote exactly what he felt with a lot of reaction, of course, reactivity, but he never sent the letter. So imagine that it would be like this in the comment fields in the social media nowadays, that people first write and then they rethink before they send. It will be so very different, I think, because I don't think people are bad or anything like that, but I think it just comes out too quickly. And I think this is what meditation really helps you about, not to be so reactive. When stimuli hits the mind, you use a meditation to expand that spaciousness in between the stimuli and the response. I would use the word response instead of reactivity, because response is thoughtful and not only subjective. It's also can be careful and consider other people's perspective and reaction it will bring if you throw this out on someone. So that is very clear for everyone that meditating for a longer time. I think they can understand that it's a very beautiful feeling in between stimuli and response, just to be in this gap. And it can be so vast and beautiful. And even if you're hit by harsh words or anything like that, it's like they are wading in the gap. And again, you have that option to react and just snap on it, or you can just, it's okay, it can be there. Of course, it shouldn't make us like we don't care about things, of course, but yes. I'm quite sure that if we want to live in a more peaceful world and with more loving kindness, response is much, much better than reactivity.
Response is much better than reactivity. That's wonderful. And it also ties to another sentence that is very nice. And it connects to, I think, having that space between the stimulus, between what comes in, and then what you are doing with it. And if there's a place in between where that is, you can hold that, you can sit with it, you can be with it. That doesn't mean you're not going to do anything about it.
No.
But, and this comes to the next sentence that, once again, I'm poetically translating. Being should be the continuous basis of doing.
Yeah, that's very
nice. And this is wonderful because it doesn't say just being, no doing. But it says doing can have a basis. And I also love the word continuous, which has a feeling of constantly refreshing itself, you know? So maybe you could say something about this idea of being and doing.
I think that came out of the idea I used to call it post-meditation, because at some point when you're meditating, I mean, that's kind of the easy part to meditate. Of course, there are distractions, but if you meditate for some time, you learn how to cope with the distractions. but it's much harder to leave the cushion and stand up and meet the others, the other people, the family members, relatives, friends, opponents, and stuff like that. That is when meditation really begins. And I call it post-meditation. I think that for all meditators, at some point, the effects of meditation in the formal meditation has to start to spill over and start building a bridge into the everyday life.
Yes.
You can't meditate on compassion and then just go around and snap off people. Then it's something off topic with your technique, I think. It has to be shown in your way of living at some point. So I think it's like this continuous thing is like you remember all the time this room inside yourself. You remember this nature of yourself or this spaciousness in between the stimuli and response, if you can call it that. And also I think that is very nice because the word in Tibetan, drempa, used for mindfulness, is actually translated remembrance, to recollect something. Yes. And the word meditation in Tibetan is gomgyap, to meditate. It actually means to habituate, to become familiar. So this is really interesting. It's not just something that you acquire, some stress reduction. After some time, you habituate, so you start to change. So something inside you becomes the natural state. And then this can be continuous in whatever you do, hopefully.
Thank you very much. So in addition to your two books, which we're going to also link, you're also the creator or co-creator of a meditation mindfulness app.
Yeah.
and I see it's also available in Germany. So we're also going to link that. So if people would like to connect more with you, if people would like to find out a little bit beyond the book, how can they, you know, maybe participate with you? What would be good ways to reach you or to interact with your thoughts or your contents, or maybe go to take a course or something like that? What would you recommend?
Yes, the mindfulness app or the Achtsamkeit app, it's called in German, actually. I was a co-founder. We started 2010, but I left the company 2017. So I'm no longer part. So I'm not a voice in the app or anything like that. But I think the best part is, of course, the book. It's a good introduction to read about my thoughts about this topic. And then maybe it's a boring answer, but Instagram is a nice platform too. And I keep updating there, and I try to give some practices, advices for meditation practices, and some reflections about these topics as well. And then I had some plans before the pandemic to do some workshops abroad. I've done Barcelona before, but hopefully I can be able to do that later on also abroad. I also plan to do some online course in meditation in English. I had that before, but I think I will do that again. But so maybe Instagram is my name, Magnus_Fried.
Okay, perfect. No, we're going to post all of that also in the...
Fried actually means peace.
You know, and Magnus, you know, it's funny that you say that, because today I said to my wife, Magnus Fried, without knowing that Fried, because Fried in German, Frieden is peace.
Mm. Yes, so exactly. It's quite fast.
Yes. So Magnus is like the big one.
Yeah.
So, so I was like, I'm going to talk to a guy that even if it's the wrong translation of the name, right? I just said it jokingly. I'm going to talk to a guy whose name is Great Peace.
It is.
So I was like, this is what I need, because I had a horrible day today so far. It's only like 12 o'clock. But my day was already fucked.
So I'm sorry.
I was like, I'm speaking to the guy called Great Peace. This is what I need.
But actually, I used to say when I host workshops and talks, I used to say that I'm sorry that this name is not like a yoga artist name, anything like that. It's just a Swedish soldier name from, from south of Sweden. So I will make you disappointed.
You know, in Buddhism, and maybe you'd like to share also, but when you take refuge, you go with a teacher, and in some traditions you will receive a name, you know. Yes. You receive a Buddhist name.
Yes.
So I received the Buddhist name from my teacher, and the translation is indestructible patience.
Oh, that's a nice and one.
I tell everyone that he was just playing a joke on me. Like, no, he was just messing with me. He's looking at me and he's like, I'm going to play a joke on you. Because this indestructible patience is definitely not my thing. So, you know.
Maybe he saw that it will come to you later on. So we'll honor the name later.
We will see what happens. Do you have a refuge name?
Yes, I have. Kama Kiesan Chöten, it was named. But I never use it, actually.
What does it mean?
Kama Kiesan Chöten. I'm not really sure, actually. I think karma is star here. I have to leave that. I'm not really sure.
Okay.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah, no problem. I think Magnus Fried is like the great piece.
It works fine with me. Yeah.
What more refuge name do you need? You know,
you can retranslate it. If you translate it to Sanskrit, my Sanskrit teacher used to call me Mahashanti.
Mahashanti, there you go.
Jeez.
Mahashanti. Man, there you go. If you ever do the 3-year retreat, you become a lama, it's Mahashanti, you know, it's already there.
The Swedish lama Mahashanti.
Fantastic.
No, Magnus Fried will be good enough for me in this life.
Nice.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I want to be mindful of your time. I could go on speaking to you, and maybe if you're down for it, we should do a part two, because I'm only just beginning to pick your brain, you know.
Yes, I love to. This was wonderful speaking to you. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Yeah. Very, very much. Thank you very much. And also, I'm very much looking forward to, just in the beginning, we had a little talk, and you mentioned that you would be cool with supplying a small, like, guided practice for the people in the Bad Meditators Club. So if anyone hears it here from the Bad Meditators Club, then you can also find some very soon some guided practice from Magnus.
I love that name, Bad Meditators Club, and absolutely, I love to share meditation with all you
Thank
guys.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it. Thank you very much for your time once again.
Thank you very much.
We'll post all the information. The book is called Stille finden in einer hektischen Welt, ein Wegweiser zu Gelassenheit und innerer Ruhe. And this beautiful one is written by the Mahashanti, the great peace. So what can go wrong? It's a high recommendation. Thank you, man.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Wenn du dich für die Inhalte dieses Podcasts interessierst, na, dann hast du den Podcast vielleicht auch schon mehrmals gehört und weißt, was ich jetzt sagen werde. www.curse.de ist meine Homepage und ist auch die Anlaufadresse für alles, was weiterführend ist. Wenn du dich weiter über diese Themen informieren willst, wenn du vielleicht auch selber Erfahrungen machen willst, da gibt es zum Beispiel die Fragen deines Lebens, den 100% kostenfreien Kurs, wo du mit meinem Buch 199 Fragen an dich selbst arbeiten kannst, aber auch das Buch gar nicht haben musst, sondern einfach mit Fragen in dein eigenes Leben schauen kannst. Es gibt auch viele andere Dinge wie den Bad Meditators Club und. Und ich würde mich freuen, wenn du da reinschaust und uns dort begegnest. Bis wir uns wiederhören, nur das Beste für dich und alles Liebe.